encounters with Jesus, and we're going to read the story of the centurion. And it's recorded in two places, and the two accounts are a little different, so we're going to read them both. First of all, in the Gospel according to St. Matthew, chapter 8, at verse 5, and then in the Gospel according to St. Luke, chapter 7, at the beginning of the chapter. First of all, then, in the Gospel according to St. Matthew, chapter 8, you perhaps will notice that the end of chapter 7 is the end of the Sermon on the Mount. That covers Matthew 5, 6, and 7. The beginning of chapter 8 is the story of how a leper came to Jesus and was healed, and we take it up at verse 5. As Jesus entered Capernaum, a centurion came forward to him, beseeching him and saying, "Lord, my servant is lying paralyzed at home in terrible distress." And Jesus said to him, "I will come and heal him." But the centurion answered him, "Lord, I am not worthy to have you come under my roof, but only say the word, and my servant will be healed. For I am a man under authority with soldiers under me, and I say to one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes, and to my slave, do this, and he does it." When Jesus heard him, he marveled and said to those who followed him, "Truly I say to you, not even in Israel," and remember, the centurion was a Gentile, "truly I say to you, not even in Israel have I found such faith. I tell you, many will come from east and west and sit at table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven, while the sons of the kingdom will be thrown into the outer darkness. Their men will weep and gnash their teeth." And to the centurion Jesus said, "Go, be it done for you as you have believed," not as you have asked, "be it done for you as you have believed." And the servant was healed at that very moment. Turn over now to St. Luke's Gospel, chapter 7. Where we have the same story recorded a little differently in verses 1 to 10, and then after the story, we have another miracle of the raising from the dead of the son of the widow of Nain. But we read St. Luke's Gospel, chapter 7, verses 1 to 10. After Jesus had ended all his sayings, that is, the Sermon on the Mount in the hearing of the people, he came down the hillside and he entered Capernaum. Now a centurion had a slave who was dear to him, who was sick and at the point of death. When he heard of Jesus, he sent to him elders of the Jews. The other story said that the man came himself. He sent to him elders of the Jews, asking Jesus to come and heal his slave. And when they came to Jesus, they besought him earnestly, saying, "This man is worthy to have you do this for him, for he loves our nation, and he built us our synagogue in Capernaum." And Jesus went with them. When he was not far from the house, the centurion sent friends to Jesus, saying to him, "Lord, do not trouble yourself, for I am not worthy to have you come under my roof. Therefore I did not presume to come to you, but say the word, and let my servant be healed. For I am a man," some of the translators say it should be, "for I too," or "I also," just like you, "am a man set under authority, with soldiers under me. And I say to one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes, and to my slave, do this, and he does it. When Jesus heard this, he marveled at him, and turned and said to the multitude that followed him, I tell you, not even in Israel have I found such faith. And when those who had been sent returned to the house, they found the slave well. Amen, and may God bless to our hearts the reading of his word. Bibles to the story of the centurion and his servant and Jesus and a whole lot of other people as we read it in these two passages in Luke chapter 7 and Matthew chapter 8. And there are clear differences in the two accounts given in these two records of the gospel. But if you read the two accounts carefully, you will see that they complement each other. They do not in any sense contradict each other. A great, great many of the so-called difficulties in the Bible are not really difficulties if people will just take time to read the Bible carefully. Now, when you read the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, you begin to see just what a fascinating life Jesus had. Not just in terms of the wide range and variety of his preaching and his teaching and his miracles, but in the tremendous variety of people that he met and dealt with. People of all classes of society, including the untouchables, like the leper. A great fuss being made at the moment of one of the royal family touching a leper. Jesus did it a lot. And not in days when leprosy has been largely moved away from its sinister nature, but when it was the most dread disease. And Jesus touched the lepers. He had people from all different classes of society, including the untouchables, people in all sorts of conditions, the rich, the poor, the sick, the healthy, the educated and the uneducated, the religious and the irreligious. He had a most fascinating life, meeting and dealing with such a wide range of people. And when you read the Gospels carefully, you see quite clearly that the reactions of the various people were also varied. Not all the people liked Jesus. And those who disliked Jesus most were the religious people. That is, the people who went to the synagogue every Sabbath day. The equivalent would be the people who go to church every Sunday. They were the people who disliked Jesus most of all. And not all, even among those who liked Jesus, not all who benefited from Jesus came to faith in him. Isn't there a story of 10 lepers who were healed? And 9 of the 10, all that mattered to them was they were healed of their leprosy. Only one came back to express gratitude, the gratitude of faith to Jesus. And he was an outsider. He was a Samaritan. Not all who benefited from Jesus came to faith in him. And some who seemed to have faith, and some who seemed to grow in their faith, in the end disappointed Jesus and turned away from him. But when you read the four Gospels carefully, you will see quite clearly that the variety of response to Jesus and reaction to Jesus did not in any sense deter Jesus. He simply went on with his ministry. He went on with the work that God had given him to do, because the issues of that work were in God's hands. And that was something he made very, very plain when he told the parable of the sower, in which parable 3/4 of the seed eventually came to nothing, but the quarter that was fruitful more than justified all the work and all the effort. And in the ongoing story, from time to time, someone simply thrilled Jesus by their faith. And that's the centurion. Faith, in a sense, that was quite unexpected. There weren't many of the Roman centurions who had faith. Faith that was strong, faith that was clear, faith that was humble. Oh, I love the way the man, the Jews said, we'll come to this later. Oh, he's worthy, the man. Oh, no, I'm not. I am not worthy, holy Lord, that thou shouldst come to me. Just speak the word. Faith that was strong and clear and without hesitation. That kind of faith seen in this centurion, who was a Roman, that is, he was a Gentile, that is, in the eyes of the Jews, he was an outsider. And the Jews, by and large and traditionally, referred to the Gentiles as Gentile dogs. They counted them as of no value at all. And in our story, as we read it, there were two things said about this centurion. The Jews said, he is worthy. He loves our nation. He built us a synagogue. But I can't help wondering what the Jews' reaction was to the words in Matthew chapter 8, verses 11 and 12, when he said, I tell you, many will come from east and west and sit at table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven, while the sons of the kingdom, that is, the privileged Jews, will be thrown into outer darkness. I don't know what the Jews thought of that or how they reacted. That's what the Jews said. He is worthy. He loves our nation. He built us our synagogue. What did Jesus say? Jesus said, not even in Israel have I found faith like this. And I sat for quite a while pondering, because I know just a little bit about human nature. And I suppose over the years I've learned a good lot about Christians. And I found myself wondering what the reaction of the 12 inner core disciples was when Jesus said, you know, I haven't found faith like this anywhere. Would they be saying, what about us? We're the ones who have left all and followed you. Were they jealous of the centurion? Were they offended when Jesus said, you know, I haven't come across faith like this anywhere? If a complete stranger came to church and settled with us, and after a few weeks I said to somebody, oh, you know, that fellow who's just come, I haven't come across faith like that in all my 40 years of ministry. How would you react? Wouldn't you? But we're the ones who've slogged on with you all these years. Well, yes. You know me well enough to know that I wouldn't devalue that in the slightest. But Jesus said, not even in Israel have I found faith
like this. Did the disciples feel unappreciated? That certainly wasn't Jesus' intention. When Jesus said, I haven't come across faith like this, he was really saying, oh, listen, all of you, he was speaking to more than the 12, he was speaking to the crowd of people. He said, oh, my friends, when you see strong, confident faith like this, faith that is willing to take me at my word, oh, be encouraged to be like that. So we set the scene. It's all happening in Capernaum, just down the village by the Sea of Galilee, just down at the foot of the Mount, of the Sermon on the Mount. And I still remember in the scorching sun, walking down the slopes of the Sermon on the Mount, heading in the direction of Capernaum. Well, Capernaum at that time was a town with a significant military garrison. There was the military barracks. There were the soldiers. They were always visible. And in Capernaum, there was a big tax office where people, for example, like Levi once worked. And what we have to remember in this story is that the whole nation, and indeed a great part of the known world at that time, was under the military rule of Rome. Now, the military rule of Rome was highly competent. That's why we still point out that such and such is a Roman road. We are impressed even still with the Roman roads. It was military rule. It was competent. It was also ruthless. Life was regarded as very cheap. It was corrupt. History books tell you that. It was cruel. Their favorite form of carrying out execution was by crucifixion, a terrible form of execution. And the military power of Rome was pagan. And within the whole empire of Rome, politics and power struggles were never ending. And it is significant in a situation like that, that there was so little or nothing at all really said by Jesus in the course of his life and ministry, so little said about war or pacifism or revolution. And all during his life and ministry, he either evaded or he deliberately quenched any attempt to make him a king. Any attempt to make him a political figure. Read it in John chapter 16, verse 15, at the end of the story of the feeding of the 5,000, when he became aware that the people were keyed up ready to make him a king, he squashed it straight away. And towards the end of his life, it's recorded in John chapter 18 at verse 36, when he stood before Pilate, the Roman governor, Jesus said, my kingdom is not of this world. If it was, my people would fight. He refused to let the gospel, not simply the gospel message, but the gospel of which he was the incarnation, he refused to let it be manipulated into a social and political thing. And in this he was completely in accord with John the Baptist before him, because people came to John the Baptist and said, what will we do? You're calling us to repentance and faith. Are you soldiers? Be good soldiers. Are you tax collectors? Be honest and take not a penny more than you should. And Paul says the same later on in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Now, none of this revolution stuff. Abide in the calling you are in. when Christ laid hold upon you and brought you salvation, and wait to see what he makes plain as his will for you and for your life. And I say this quite deliberately this morning. It is important that in the Gospels and in the Epistles, there is no sign whatever of the modern theology of revolution and liberation, and no politicizing of the gospel, because such tendencies are attitudes focused upon man. They put man in the center, and they are focused upon this world to the exclusion of the need for salvation and for faith and for hope in respect of the world that is to come. In his dealings with the Roman centurion, Jesus didn't challenge this man with regard to his army career. He didn't challenge this man saying, well, if you've got faith, why are you working for a pagan Roman empire? He didn't even challenge the man about his treatment of soldiers when the man said, when I give an order, they do it. And the reason why Jesus didn't challenge on that level is really quite simple. If there is grace in the heart, as there certainly was in the centurion, if there is grace in the heart, it will make that man or that woman operate as salt and light and yeast in society, working change that is really irresistible. And there is no doubt at all that there was grace in the centurion's heart. And it is evident in his care for his servant. In these days, if a servant, a slave, was ill and paralyzed, no use for working and showing indication that life was ebbing away, the slave would be left to die. But not this man's slave. I'm told that the words used are different in the Greek. A servant, yes. In the other place, it could be my lad. There's affection in that. And if there was just a little bit more affection and respect nowadays on the part of employers and on the part of employees, the whole industrial scene would be very, very different from what it is. And so we come to the details of the story. And it focuses on the centurion's faith. The more I read the two accounts of this story, the more I seem to feel that the miracle of the healing of this servant who was dying, that miracle is virtually ignored. Oh yes, it's mentioned, but that's about all. Because the miracle of faith was far more significant, especially in a place like Capernaum. Because if ever there was a place of dogged unbelief, it was Jesus' hometown of Capernaum. We've quoted it before, we quote it again or refer to it again from Matthew chapter 11 verse 23, where Jesus said, O Capernaum, if the mighty works had been done in places like Sodom that have been done in you, even places like Sodom and Gomorrah would have repented. But you lot, you've seen the power of God, you've heard the gracious words of God, you had the very incarnate Son of God living amongst you, rubbing shoulders with you day in, day out, and there's not a trace of the softening of your heart. I think the longer I'm in the ministry, the more awed I am and the more frightened I think I am at unbelief. That people can listen to the word of Jesus, that people can see, as it were, word pictures of Jesus, that people can be made aware of the presence of Jesus and all the glory of his grace and all the gentleness of his love and all his transforming power, and remain absolutely indifferent. It's something that frightens me. It really does. I think it frightens me more than carnal indulgence and all the crudities of life and activity that I read about so much in my daily papers. Yes, that grieves me. Yes, these ugly things make me think of human evil going beyond the bounds of human evil into what I've called before the demonizing of society. And my friends, it's happening before our very eyes. And it should cause us to be very alarmed about the next decade. For a long time now, filmmakers have been making dreadful films about all sorts of people, including infant prodigies, turning in to the most terrible monsters. Pray a lot about what's going to happen in the next decade. Yes, the demonizing of society disturbs me. But I think when I'm brought face to face with that totally indifferent unbelief that was such a mark of Capernaum, I think that troubles me and disturbs me even more. And I bid you think about that. Because I'm not at all sure that all of you who come here Sunday morning by Sunday morning and are hearing these stories of Jesus, I'm not sure that all of you respond in faith. Is it not true that some of you would say, oh yes, I quite like coming, but it really doesn't mean anything to me? That's a very, very dangerous condition to be in. And in Capernaum, that kind of place, there was a synagogue built by this centurion, very possibly at his own expense. It's no wonder the Jews liked him. As far as I can understand, one of the rulers of that synagogue in Capernaum was Jairus. And I wonder if Jairus and the centurion ever chatted together. And if they did, I wonder what they talked about. I don't know. We are not told how much contact the centurion had with the synagogue services after the synagogue was built. I'm pretty sure he would be invited along officially to the opening of the synagogue and the dedication of the synagogue. And perhaps being the kind of man he was, he could well have gone along there, out just an act of friendliness, if you like, on the Sabbath or during the week to some of the synagogue services. I wouldn't be at all surprised, because in these days, not only among the Jews but among the Gentiles, there were many people with inquiring minds, just as there are today. I was asking the Reverend Eric Alexander the other day at a Presbytery committee meeting how things were going with their monthly lunchtime service in the middle of town at St. George's Throne, entitled Introducing the Christian Faith. And he said, it's astonishing the number of business people who are coming. You see, people have inquiring minds. And then and now, there were a great many people who were deeply dissatisfied with secular materialism. And yet at the same time, religion, well, in the Roman side it had all to do with superstition, and in the Jewish side it was by and large formal and dead. And yet if the centurion went along to any of the services in the synagogue, he would be aware of the reverence with which the law of God was taken out and unrolled and read. I don't know, as I said a moment ago, if he had much contact with Jairus. I could imagine these two men often talking. You know, after a synagogue service, time for a cup of coffee. And they'd go and they'd sit and they would talk. And the centurion would talk about his Roman background, and Jairus would talk about the Jewish tradition and the faith of Abraham and Isaac and of Jacob. And the centurion would go again to the synagogue and hear the scriptures read, and they read through the scriptures systematically. And it could very well, I'm only speculating, it could very well have been that the centurion with his 100 soldiers may have been on police or security duty during the preaching of the Sermon on the Mount. Because the Romans were very, very worried whenever there was a crowd. And there was a huge crowd of Jews hanging on the words of this man, Jesus. I wouldn't be at all surprised if a detachment of soldiers, and off you go. Just keep a low profile, but keep your eyes open. But I can imagine the centurion maybe forgetting a wee bit about changing his guards and all that kind of thing, and being enraptured as he listened to the words of Jesus. Have you ever thought what it must have been like to sit in an open-air crowd and listen to Jesus Christ, the Son of God, speaking and teaching and explaining and making you become aware of the reality of God and of His redeeming love? Then there arose a situation that we can be clear about. A situation in which the centurion's money and the centurion's religious friends couldn't help him at all. Here was something that couldn't be dealt with money. This servant lad that he liked so much and valued so highly was seriously ill, paralyzed, suffering great pain, and he thought he was dying. And the centurion sent to Jesus. There's so much about this centurion that we can't explain, except this, in terms of the working of God's Holy Spirit. And if there is one lesson we should take home from this service, it is encouragement. Encouraging our hope with regard to people who, as far as we know, are complete outsiders with regard to the gospel. I suppose there could have been lots of people who would have said of the centurion, "Oh, you'll never get him to go to Jesus." Well, you're entitled to your opinion. But there he is. He's sent to Jesus. He had heard about Jesus. That's what it says in Luke chapter 7, verse 3. When he heard of Jesus. And if he had heard about Jesus, that's an indication of the importance of witness. And he sent some of the Jewish elders, and it's amazing that they consented to go because they didn't like Jesus. But then here was a man who had built them a synagogue, and, well, I mean to say, it's lovely that people that God conscripts to do his work, isn't it? The elders of the Jews who hated Jesus, but they trotted off like message boys at the request of the centurion to Jesus. According to Matthew's account, the centurion came personally. It may have been that he sent the elders. And then when he realized that the elders were actually bringing Jesus, the centurion, "Oh, we can't have this." And down he went and said, The Jews said of this man, he is worthy. The man himself said, I am not worthy that you should come to my house. He may have been aware of just how bitterly Jesus would be criticized if he did actually go into the house of a Gentile, which is something that I don't know that Jesus ever really did in the gospel story. Keep me right sometime. He was aware that Jesus was devalued by the Jews and by the Romans and distrusted by the Jews and by the Romans. But you see this man's humility and his honesty. I did not presume to come to you. Well, you see, a centurion didn't go walking through the streets on his own. He would at least have a small platoon of soldiers. And if Capernaum saw the centurion and maybe six or eight soldiers marching down, heading to Jesus, they would say, oh, he's going to be arrested. They would have drawn the wrong conclusion. Oh, said the centurion, I wouldn't do that. He wouldn't presume. And the centurion didn't think that his problem had priority over everything else that Jesus was doing. And in any case, this man's concern was not for himself, but for his young servant. And so we come, as we close, to the centurion's faith. We don't know that he had ever actually met with and spoken to Jesus before. As we've indicated, he may very well have watched and listened. He had heard about Jesus. And on the basis of what he had heard, he believed. And we notice his words. He said, I am an officer. I am only an officer. But when I speak, it is done. Not because of me, but because of the authority that is behind me. And he said to Jesus, I may not know all that much about you, but it's obvious that behind you there is the authority of God. The centurion had heard people saying, no man ever spoke like this man. This man doesn't speak like this guy. This man speaks with authority. Oh, said the centurion, I know what I'm talking about here. I speak and it is done, and I've no doubt at all because the authority of Caesar is behind me. You too are a man under authority. Oh, I can imagine Jesus smiling at that man. He saw. He understood. He recognized that Jesus was God's man. That the authority of God was in Jesus' word and in Jesus' action. And the man said, just say the word and it'll be done. I wonder if the last time he'd been at the synagogue, they might have come round in the sequence of readings to the book of Genesis. And the centurion may have heard it being read that God spoke and it was done. And he said, speak. Oh, he said, I've read it in the Old Testament. Just say the word and it will be done. Again, I'm speculating, but I believe that if Jesus had said to the centurion, and he would have said it gently, if Jesus had said, it is not part of God's plan to heal the servant, I believe the centurion would have accepted it. Because as far as the centurion was concerned, the man in charge He was looking at Jesus. The man in charge was a man to be trusted and to be obeyed. And that is exactly what we must do, even when, or especially when, we don't really understand. Trust me, said Jesus. And we'll sing in a moment, my times are in thy hand. And to my mind, that is peace that passes understanding. Amen, and may God bless to us his word.